My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Lots to talk about today, actually, between domestic and international economic and political events. There's certainly a hell of a lot going on. I just want to start off by talking about a couple of pieces of Irish data of interest. Earlier this week, we got the Irish unemployment data. The unemployment rate has jumped to 4.4% of the labour force, up from 4.1% in March. Youth unemployment is up from 9.2% to 10.6%. 124,200 people registered unemployed. That's up 9,900 over the past year. So what does that tell us? It's a small deterioration in labour market conditions. Given what we've observed in the hospitality sector, and I've spoken about restaurants and so on, that sort of increase in unemployment doesn't really cause me any surprise or concern. I mean, basically, the labour market is still in a strong place. And indeed, the strength of the labour market has been demonstrated again on Friday afternoon with the release of the Exchequer returns for the end of April. And April is not a big month for tax revenue collection. But looking at the first 4 months of the year, we ran a deficit of 1.2 billion compared to 3.7 billion in 23. There's a lot of timing issues from month to month that influence the deficit. But looking at the tax revenue side, overall tax revenues in the first 4 months up by 2.6%, income tax up by 7.1%, and in April, it was 6.4% higher than April of last year. So that is indicative of the ongoing strength of the labour market. The VAT take up by 6.3% year on year in the first 4 months. So that is indicative of a reasonable level of consumer spending, but more particularly the pretty strong growth we're seeing in the motor industry, new car registrations, because there's a lot of VAT included in that. The one item that we've said many times that we will be watching very closely during 2024 is what's happening on the corporation tax side. And in the first 4 months, it's 800 million down on the same period last year. The Department of Finance is putting this down to timing factors rather than any fundamental deterioration in the corporation tax picture. But as I say, hopefully the department is correct, but this is something we certainly will be watching closely from month to month.
that's a run of a number of months now where it's coming under. Is that right, Jim? Corporation tax?
Yes.
Slightly?
Last November, after three very weak months, it came in very, very strong. And of course, that was really important because November is the big month for corporation tax receipts. And January, February, March, it has been quite weak, but there's very little collected. I think in the first 4 months of the year, as far as I know, it's about 2.2 billion collected. And that's probably out of a corporation tax take of up to 26 billion for the full year. So I wouldn't jump to any conclusions whatsoever.
I can remember when 2 billion was a lot of money, Jim.
Indeed, Chris. But 2 billion as a percentage of the 26 we're likely to collect in corporation tax, you know, these are not big corporation tax payment months. That's really what I'm saying more than anything else.
We're up to about 2 billion for the Children's Hospital now, aren't we?
At least, yes. And yeah. Still not open.
So it still pays for something.
It does. Oh, well, yeah. Oh, it's important. Don't let me denigrate it. And actually, in the first 4 months, gross voted spending by government, this is spending that the government approves in the Dáil, basically, it's up by 12.1% in the first 4 months of the year. So there's a lot of spending going on. And, you know, some of that is due to the budgetary measures, but also we're seeing significant increases in public services. Listening to the opposition parties, particularly Sinn Féin, talk about government spending, you'd swear we're spending nothing in terms of investment in public services. There's a lot of money being pumped into the system. Of course, it is a different question entirely if all of this spending actually results in an improvement in the quality of public services. I guess what I'm describing here in Ireland, and there is an issue certainly with translating that sort of expenditure into output or outcomes, is the same in virtually most countries in the world. And certainly the country you're sitting in at the moment, the UK, it's a very similar situation.
Yeah, there was some data out this week confirming exactly what you're saying there, Jim, that productivity in the public sector in the UK has become, over the recent past, a really big problem. In that it's at best flat and at worst it's declining. It's tricky to measure, but there certainly seems to be the case that we're not getting the bang for our taxpayers' buck from the public sector in the UK. There may be all sorts of good reasons, bad reasons. Nobody seems quite sure why this has happened. But those of us that are very prejudiced and bigoted of nature, like me, say things like the NHS needs more money, absolutely. But the NHS also needs an army of people wandering around hospitals with stopwatches and clipboards because the efficiency of these places by eye when one visits them often looks to be lacking, shall we say. As I say, that's very prejudiced and bigoted. And I'm sure a lot of my healthcare friends will be on my case for saying that. But there is, in the data, a problem with public sector productivity in the UK. Absolutely, Jim.
Moving over to your neck of the woods and the political scene there, for people like Alistair Campbell and yourself, this must be an orgasmic Friday. The local election results are coming through. We had the by-election result in Blackpool where there was a 26% swing to the Labour Party. The Tories lost the seat, Labour took it. And I think most worrying from a Tory point of view was the fact that the Reform Party came in just behind the Conservatives. All in all, it's been seen as a bit of a washout for the Conservative Party, which will make you very happy. It's interesting to see the Tories are grasping onto. They're taking major solace from the fact that they held on to the mayoralty of Tea Valley, which apparently is very significant Tory stronghold. Lord Ben Hoosh has held on to that particular mayoralty.
Only by distancing himself from Rishi Sunak, yes, however, indeed, during the campaign. Indeed.
Yes.
So there is a sting in that particular tale. Yeah. So yeah, and they hang on to something called Harlow, which is in Essex, I think, which is classic Tory territory. So the results aren't uniformly good for Labour. As I said to you a little while ago, Jim, I'm not going to vote Labour again, ever, because of their stance over Europe. And the straw that broke the camel's back for me after many problems with Keir Starmer's stance on Europe essentially he doesn't have one, was when Brussels offered the UK a very limited freedom of movement amendment for young people in particular, to include things like UK students rejoining the Erasmus scheme. And of course, the Tories said no. They said it was freedom of movement by the back door. And so did the Labour Party. So these people are a disgrace. The greatest thing, a civilizing thing, is freedom of movement, in my opinion. It's one of the great civilizing forces present in Europe, is freedom of movement of people. Actually, I think it's been a great civilizing force between Britain and Ireland since 1922, is it? Or 23. I can't remember the exact date. There's a great article by Dermot Ferriter in the Irish Times today about the common travel area, which answers a lot of the questions that we asked in our last podcast, because nobody seems to know very much about it. A lot of people don't even know that it exists, certainly here in the UK. They've no idea what it is if you mention it to them. And it's got a very interesting history, according to this article, because it's been deliberately, not quite hidden, but at least kept under wraps. And because there have been amendments to it, there have been new agreements along the way that didn't receive an awful lot of publicity. And unusually, the EU stood back and said that Britain and Ireland can continue with this arrangement for as long as we like. And the problem's always, of course, been the Irish border. It's a very interesting article. Go read it if you're interested in the history of the CTA, the Common Travel Area, and why it's in trouble today. And we talked about that last time. But freedom of movement of people between Britain and Ireland, I think, has been a civilizing influence on these islands. And I think it's a great addition to Europe over the last number of years. And it's the great tragedy that Britain doesn't want it anymore. So I'm not going to vote Labour because of its stance overall on Europe, but in particular this one on freedom of movement. Because
you
I think
are called Conservative, yeah.
I'll probably end up voting for somebody independent, actually, depending on who runs in the constituency that I will be voting in. I haven't made my mind up yet. I doubt very much, Jim, if I'll be voting Conservative. I've got too many ancestors that would come back and haunt me who would trade unionists and dockers and steelworkers back in the day. And I, you know, just as you've never quite left the farm, I've never quite left the industrial working classes.
Okay, we're recording this on Friday evening and all of the local election results haven't come through yet. It's clear there is a massive swing to Labour. Absolutely zero surprise there, because it had been well heralded, and I think any other result would be truly shocking. And if you extrapolate that forward to a general election, whenever it's going to be held before next March, you would expect to see this being repeated, and you would expect to see the Conservative Party being absolutely decimated. Where for Rishi Sunak at this stage?
Well, I think decimated is a very good use of language there, Jim. It stems from various sources, but one source, this may be apocryphal, is that it's what the Roman legions used to do to their soldiers to keep them in line once a year, is that they take 1 in 10 of them out and kill them. And sometimes it was to just provide discipline. Sometimes it was punishment. Sometimes it was because there had been infringements and soldiers had to be punished. The Tory party isn't going to be decimated. It's going to be eviscerated, I think is actually a better word. It's going to be a lot more than a 10% decline, at least if today's results are any kind of a pointer. And for Sunak, he's toast. I think he'll be on his way to California and will become a tech bro, run a hedge fund, or do whatever these kinds of people do once they've been turfed out of being prime minister. He'll follow Nick Clegg, who was a UK politician, a Lib Dem politician, actually, in David Cameron's coalition government back in the day, about, 14 years ago now. And he's a Facebook multimillionaire now. And politicians wonder why we have profound skepticism, if not loathing, of them when they go off and do things like that. Nick Clegg famously promised faithfully never to introduce student tuition fees here in the UK. And we know what happened next. Students are going into massive debt because of these sorts of things. Sunak is a hopeless politician, Jim. He spent his time since being prime minister making all sorts of promises and not keeping them. He had famously 5 tests, most of which have not been met. And the 5 tests have become 1, which is stop the boats. We talked about that last time. I don't think anybody cares about stopping boats. Some people do. Clearly, some people are very exercised by it. but the average person in the street is not. Sunak, when he took office, if he was a good politician, would have said, right, what's gone wrong? Boris Johnson and Liz Truss are what's gone wrong, and I must now distance myself from those two politicians and their policies. And we need to get Britain working again, because Britain isn't working. And the slogan I would have adopted if I was Sunak would not have been stop the boats, is far less sexy and attention-grabbing. You could say, let's stop the rot rather than the boats, or let's get Britain working again, working in a very general sense, not just in terms of employment, but in terms of all the things that we know are not working, from the utilities to the hospitals to the trains to the sewage in our rivers and on our beaches and in our seas. The list goes on and on. You've heard me talk about it many, many times. So the reason why I raise that is that it explains why Sunak is such a hopeless politician. He chose the wrong target. He chose a target that didn't matter. He chose a target that he couldn't meet. What he should have done was ask the question, what exercises the majority of voters up and down the country, not the right-wing lunatic, batshit crazy wingnuts in my party? And that would have been an election-winning strategy. Instead, he just appeased the right, as so many people have done before him. And it hasn't worked. Surprise, surprise. And in my defense, Your Honor, I did say it wasn't going to work. I did say he was a hopeless politician the day he took office, and that he wouldn't tackle the issues that people care about in this country. People care about the fact that Britain doesn't work anymore. And one of the other reasons, perhaps the other reason why I'm not going to vote Labour, is I don't think Keir Starmer, A, understands this, and even if he does, he hasn't got any answers to this very fundamental problem. So a plague on all their houses, Jim. I don't think Sunak's going to work. And I think Starmer, if and when he becomes Prime Minister, is going to be in trouble very quickly for similar reasons to Sunak. I think he's a better politician than Sunak, but he still isn't up to the job of getting this country moving again.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Yeah, it's funny. I was observing him leaving the polling station yesterday with his wife, I presume, and he just doesn't excite any sort of passion whatsoever. Very, very dry, boring, staid individual. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. That's exactly what I'm like. But I'm not running for high office.
I think passion sometimes is a bit overrated in the modern era. It's a word we all use a lot. I would forgive him being boring. I would forgive his slightly odd voice. I'd forgive his just lack of charisma, all those things that people seem to want. If there was a policy platform behind all of that dullness that spoke to somebody that was engaged with the issues and had ideas about how to deal with Britain's problems. And I see none of that. So I see the lack of charisma and I see lack of ideas as well. So that's why I criticize him.
Chris, back in 1997, would you have voted for Blair and New Labour?
Oh, definitely. I obviously haven't been here for all of the elections over the last number of decades, but when I have been here, I have always voted Labour. I grew up in Jim Callaghan's constituency in Cardiff. Jim Callaghan was a prime minister way back in the day that not many people will remember these days. Sonny Jim was his nickname. And I remember meeting Jim Callaghan as a child, actually. As I say, he was my local MP. When Margaret Thatcher was elected in 1979, I was living in her constituency. So I had a wasted vote. This is Finchley in North London. I had a wasted vote when I voted Labour in that constituency. So yes, I have been a lifelong Labour voter when I have voted here in the UK. Yeah.
And how do you see Blair's legacy?
Obviously, it's tainted by Iraq. We could do a whole series of podcasts about that. And I think that it's also tainted by the fact of him going off and earning gazillions amounts of money since he left office and dressing it up as trying to do good in the world. I think he probably is doing a lot of good with the Blair Foundation and all the rest of it, but the money thing leaves a slightly nasty whiff, in my opinion. Jim, let's not get into Tony Blair. I could talk all day about Iraq and the all the stuff that went on about that.
Actually, Chris, the reason why I bring it up is because when the general election happens over the coming months, there is going to be a seismic change in the UK political landscape, just as there was back in 1997. I think it was real. It was kind of exciting back then. And, you know, listening and to Alistair Campbell talk about it, reading the various diaries that Alistair Campbell has written, it's all kind of exciting. It represents a change. Whereas we're going to get a seismic shift this time, but it ain't going to be terribly exciting, is it?
Well, Tony Blair, despite the fact that I did vote for him, I was an enthusiast. I would be the centrist New Labour type that he was back then. Let's park the Iraq decisions that he made. But one of the things that he was one of Napoleon's lucky generals, in that the economy he inherited in 1997 was in very good shape. And that gave him the money, particularly via the public sector finances, to do all sorts of interesting things. The economy is in dire shape. The public sector finances in particular are in terrible shape. So Keir Starmer is starting from a much worse position than Blair did. So in fairness to both men, but Starmer in particular, he's going to need to be an awful lot luckier than Blair was if he's going to be able to achieve anything. But he has to try. And I see no evidence that he is going to try. There are one or two people writing learned pieces at the moment saying that behind all this blandness, behind this lack of ideas, stands a radical, and that just wait and see what he does after he gets elected. And he's going to do all sorts of interesting things, reveal himself to be a person of ideas. I hope they're right, but I see that as motivated reasoning, as wishful thinking, all those expressions, cliches, and I have my doubts.
Okay. Chris, moving across the pond again, if our listeners go back to, I don't know how many podcasts ago, some months ago, we had a little bit of a wager where I said US rates would come down in 2024. You said they wouldn't. And today we...
I hear the sound of goalposts moving yet again, Jim.
Today, Chris, and they're yours. Today we got the non-farm payrolls report, 175,000 increase in employment, which was well below what the market had expected and was down from 315,000 in March. The unemployment rate has jumped slightly to 3.9% of the labor force. Earnings growth is very soft, up by just 0.2%. Average weekly hours worked are coming down. We got the manufacturing purchasing managers index has softened from 51.9 to 50. The services sector has softened from 51.4 to 49.4. That's the ISM measure. So we're getting quite a bit of soft data emerging in the States.
All of a sudden,
since the Q1 GDP softness, the 1.6% last week, and it's been followed up with other soft data, as I've seen. We had Powell during the week while he was saying that rates would remain higher for longer. He seemed to indicate that actually, this 2% inflation target isn't the be-all and the end-all. So he certainly held out some hope that the Fed is of a mind at some stage to start cutting interest rates. So are you going to concede victory to me?
Never, ever. There's a lot there, Jim. And I think the discussion actually should start with a brief explanation of where the 2% inflation target came from. Because the US does it, the UK does it, and the ECB, for your interest rates, has a 2% inflation target as well. And there's a great article that refers to this in today's FT by Mohamed El Arian, a respected, very respected commentator, economist. And he references the fact that it's true that the 2% inflation target was first adopted by the New Zealand Central Bank in the early 1990s. And it was a number that he says they picked out of thin air, which I think is the truth, but it's not the whole truth. Because I remember this era, and I remember doing some work on it at the time. The reason why 2% was chosen was threefold. One, it was out of thin air, like a lot of these targets are. Two, there was a body of work around at the time that said that we were mismeasuring inflation, that inflation was being understated. Anyway, we were mismeasuring inflation such that it would be a much better idea to have a 2% inflation target. But because we mismeasure it, that is probably consistent with underlying properly measured inflation of 0% of price stability. The third reason is that central banks, for good old Keynesian monetary theory reasons, don't ever want to get themselves stuck up against 0% inflation, because then you get into problems of monetary policy not working, the sort of things that actually happened post-financial crisis that led to quantitative easing and money printing and the monetary tangles that they got themselves into. So, as I say, it goes back 30-odd years to New Zealand, numbers being picked out of the air. And El Arian is, I think, quite rightly saying the times have changed, Gov. And back the economic changes that have taken place since then are so profound, particularly ones going on at the moment, that central banks should have a rethink about these 2% inflation targets. And the US in particular, if it tried to get inflation now down to 2%, El Arian thinks that that would inflict an awful lot of economic damage. I think that's true. And the US economy, he writes, and again, I think this is absolutely accurate, was that it was an economy that did deregulation, that globalization was all the rage, liberalism, and they had a very prudent fiscal policy. All of those things are not true anymore. And structural change in the US economy through deglobalization, the AI revolution that's underway, the fact that they are no longer deregulating everything, they're actually re-regulating everything, and they are fiscally incontinent in the United States. They have an absolutely humongous budget deficit at a time of more than full employment. Again, a subject for a podcast on its own, that one. So he thinks that they should just accept that inflation where it is, basically, is fine, and that they shouldn't try to crush it. Growth is slowing, as you rightly say, with all of the data analysis that you gave us there. And really, it's about time, isn't it, Jim? Because we've been talking for nearly 2 years now about when are these higher interest rates going to slow the US economy down? And I think that they finally are. And that's the general point about the data. The particular thing that's really interesting is that it seems to me that the consumer in the US is running out of money, and that the post-pandemic savings boost has been spent and all that good stuff. The consumer confidence indicators are coming in much weaker than expected. So it seems that the big engine of growth, which isn't the only engine of growth, but the big one, the consumer, is finally slowing down. So whether or not this is a victory for you or not, I do agree that the Fed should think about cutting rates later this year, even with inflation sticking at around the 3-point-something. Okay, I concede that particular match to you. But I do claim some credit, because I think it's only in the last few weeks when the IMF were banging on about really improved short-term growth prospects for the world led by the US. I think we called time on that one, and we said no. The IMF is actually calling the top of that particular role. And so far, it has proved. So that was good timing. I mean, it gave me to think, Jim, that we ought to take up economic forecasting. What do you think?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. I've spent the morning writing a piece about economic forecasting. And maybe we should, Chris. We might make a few quid out of it.
Jim, you're sitting there in Waterford, and I know it's where you hail from. And I know that there are quite a lot of dairy farms in your part of the world. Are you alarmed by these reports coming out of the States that cattle prices on the wholesale markets are falling rapidly, or at least have done in the last day or two, because they've discovered bird flu amongst cows in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's potentially a huge story. Scientists are worried about it. They're trying to downplay the seriousness at the moment. But if bird flu transmits across to cattle, which it appears to have done, you would obviously worry about what further mutations could take it into the food chain, into humans, and so on. So it is certainly a source of deep concern. And it's unbelievable that having just come out of COVID, we're now talking about something like this. I think it's something that warrants a lot of attention. There's no doubt about that. It is definitely a source of concern. And as you say, cattle prices have fallen sharply in the States because there's now a belief that US consumers will move away from consumption of beef until there's greater clarity on this. This is something we saw in the United Kingdom in the late 1980s with BSE, when, you know, everybody stopped eating beef, basically, and we saw that market collapse. Eventually, we worked through that. But I remember being in London out at a dinner one night when during the BSE crisis at the beginning of it. And I remember the restaurant we were in with some Japanese investors basically said, listen, we've taken beef off the menu for tonight. So whatever else. So these things are very, very significant.
Something else to cheer people up with is Emmanuel Macron writing and speaking in an interview in The Economist this week. And it's a long, long series of articles, actually. The actual conversation with Emmanuel Macron, the French president, is a very, very long one. I don't know whether it's in the printed version, but I read it online this morning. And there are accompanying articles to this very long interview. It's sobering stuff, Jim. But it refers to the stuff that you and I have been talking about, the future of Europe, particularly in military terms, but not just that, but in political terms as well. But it's essentially about the threat posed by Vladimir Putin and the fact that he has to be stopped. And if he isn't stopped, he's going to go after the Baltics. He's going to go after Poland, Moldova, Bulgaria, Romania, those Eastern European countries that were once part of the Soviet Union. He is trying to recreate the USSR. And he doesn't think, well, he hopes that Europe is up to the task. He worries that it's not. And he talks about civilizations disappearing very, very quickly and references the lead up to the First World War, the lead up to the Second World War. A lot of sobering, thoughtful stuff. And I would urge anybody with an interest in this stuff to have a look at it. But it echoes the very negative sentiments that you and I have expressed about the way the world looks right now on this podcast and indeed the writing that I do every week when I publish the War and Peace Diary at weekends. So it's always nice, I guess, to see somebody far more intelligent and thoughtful and erudite than me echo our views. But nevertheless, you know, I wish that he didn't and that somebody out there of his skill and erudition would be a wee bit more optimistic than us, Jim. But it's well worth a read.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, the point about Macron, he's been making a lot of noise. He spoke in the Sorbonne earlier in the week where he was making many of the same arguments. And he was basically talking about a French nuclear umbrella over Europe. And what I find very worrying about all of that, I 100% agree, I have to say, with what Macron is saying. It's hard not to agree. But the point is really, I think, demonstrates is the lack of leadership in Europe, because Macron is definitely trying to take over the mantle of leadership of Europe because the Germans under Scholz have disappeared.
You know, you just wonder what Scholz is thinking.
You would, yeah. Lack of leadership is a huge issue.
You know, that I'm not casting aspersions here at all. So please, if you're listening, Mr. Scholz, don't sue me. But the amount of Russian infiltration into the higher reaches of German governments and society via the KGB or whatever their successor organization is scary. And if anybody's interested in that, look at something called the Wirecard scandal. Did you know that spying in Austria, Jim, is legal?
Yes.
So long as you're not spying on the Austrians. If you're a Russian spy in Vienna working to undermine the West, it's perfectly okay.
Yeah.
It's a truly weird part of the world. And I don't know whether Scholz just fancies that they're going to get cheap Russian gas back again one day or what. But Macron, he was moderately in favor of dialogue with Putin not too long ago, and he clearly has had a big change of mind based on the evidence that he sees. I don't see how anybody could not change their mind if they were that way inclined on the basis of the evidence that's there in the public domain. But there we are. Scholz clearly doesn't. So I don't know what's going on there. So it's interesting that Macron is actually clearly appealing to the UK to align with France on these security issues, because I don't think he's very confident that he's going to get much change, much money, many defense program increases from the Germans.
Okay, Chris, listen, it's great to talk. I just want to wrap up by saying I hope my sound is okay. I'm
a little bit echoey.
Yeah, I'm recording this from a room in Dungarvan, which doesn't have great acoustics yet. It will improve. I'm going to Waterford and Tipperary tomorrow night when your crowd are playing up in Croke Park. I'll be at Waterford.
Your crowd.
Leinster Rugby. Yes. I'll be down in Waterford watching Waterford play Tipperary in this sport of stick fighting, as you would call it, or hurling. But Waterford is a very interesting part of the world. Have you ever been here?
Yes, I have. My great-grandmother was from Waterford.
Yes, you told me that before. You were here, yeah?
Oh, I've been to Waterford City. Yeah, I've been to Dungarvan.
Okay.
Yeah, as a tourist. I might have even done some work down there back in the day when I used to tour around Ireland in a different lifetime. But yes, no, I am not unfamiliar with where you are.
It's a really interesting part of the world at the moment because clearly regional economic development policies are working down here. You know, we've had the Greenway open, which has transformed the village beside where I grew up. Kilmacthomas was, with the exception of Flavin's Porridge, was a one-horse town with no horse. And in the last 4 years, it has absolutely blossomed. There are coffee shops, restaurants there because of the Greenway. And indeed, as a place to invest now, for businesses that want to move out of expensive, clogged up parts of the country, like Dublin, for example.
Is it an example of regional development which smacks of central government doing something for a region? Or is it more a region pulling itself up by its own bootstraps? Or is it a bit of both?
No, it's very much a region pulling itself up by its own bootstraps, because central government hasn't been very accommodating down here in terms of developing the airport, in terms of developing a proper hospital down here for 24/7 cardiac care. So we certainly would feel down here that the place has been neglected by central government, but we have an incredibly proactive city and county manager who incidentally played hurling for Waterford in the 80s, but he really has, in my view, pull the place up by the bootstraps, and that there is a very, very positive vibe down here now, which, as somebody who grew up in the area, it certainly pleases me to see.
Well, maybe we won't be seeing quite so much of you in Dublin in the future.
You will.
Cheers, Jim. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, Chris, have a good one.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.